You know, this theme of joy has actually been an enormous tonic for me at a moment when I needed it. And I want to really emphasize that, because the key word for this service tonight is not joy so much, because we can have a lot of familiar thoughts about that, and I hope to disrupt at least some of your familiar thoughts. But the really key word is the refinding. Because, of course, joy is our natural state of being. And it's really hard sometimes even to acknowledge that, never mind to experience it. Sometimes joy, or more accurately, and I thought a lot about what would be a more accurate way, because, you know, joy is on the front of a lot of cards, isn't it, that can be somewhat banal. So what was I really wanting to, bring myself to and remind myself of in order that we could share some thoughts here this evening? And for me, the very best word was aliveness, But aliveness in a very particular way, not just in a dynamic way, because joy has quite a lot of moods. So if I was to say to you, it brings me great joy to be with you here tonight, it's not just an exuberance of joy, it's also a quiet joy, because coming together here, we come together as one body, but what also happens is that we reconnect with the individual body, the individual person that we are, in a much more holy and wholesome way, when there is that degree or element or rekindling of aliveness. Very often, and, you know, without having to give any detail whatsoever, you will know what I mean. Very often, we are connected to ourselves through our anxieties, through our worries, through our pain, through our grief. This can dominate our thinking very easily. And I thought that teaching from Pema Chodron was so profound, you know, that the world needs less of that anxiety and aggression and tragedy. And it needs far more of what we can bring to it when we feel sufficient aliveness. And of course, the really stunning thing is that when we are brave enough, when we are courageous enough, when we are willing enough to open to this depth of living, this sacred depth of living that is our natural inheritance, then joy will emerge. Joy, we don't even have to look for it. And even more than that, it will emerge even in the presence of sorrow. We know that. We learn that lesson again and again and again from people who are consciously dying, who know that they have a short time to live, and this does not happen for everyone. It's not everybody's destiny, it's not everybody's fate, it's not everybody's experience. But it happens to enough people that we can learn from it, that very often there comes, in the face of knowing that death is very near, a depth of vitality and aliveness that we could almost envy when we're still in the deluded state that we have years and years, if not centuries, if not lifetimes, to go. So I want you perhaps to think about joy not so much as something that you need to strive for, but much more as a very natural quality that you live in an invitational way with. That is, you are open to it, but you also invite it. Now, how would you do that? Well, in part, by thinking deeply and very honestly. And this is not so easy, but it's invaluable, about the barriers that you are putting between yourself and joy. And some of those barriers are very close to us. They can be physical exhaustion and physical exertion when it's too hectic. We only experience joy in the moment of experiencing it. That is, we have to be present to it for it to be present to us. And we cannot be present to joy when we are hurtling through one obligation after another and wrapping them all up in feelings of inadequacy or resentment. Inadequacy and resentment, bitterness, they are the experiences that push joy away, not sorrow. Not sorrow. Now, why not sorrow? Because sorrow is also an absolutely authentic feeling. Sorrow is also an expression of the soul. The soul doesn't ask us to be sort of jolly, jolly, jolly all the time, because there are things that we have to face that cause us sorrow. But the soul asks us to be brave enough, to keep the heart open enough, that we can not only experience sorrow fully and compassionately and passionately, but that we will also experience joy in those same ways, and that we don't live some kind of miserable, pinched life in between, never really feeling sorrow, never really feeling grief, never really feeling vulnerable, but never really feeling ecstatic or blissful or joyful or just awed. I think that in a moment Hilary's going to speak a little bit about the natural world, but the natural world speaks to the natural in us. And when we experience awe, you know, last night on Hilary's back porch in Point Chevalier, I'm very fond of Point Chevalier because we're here now in Point Chevalier. And also I lived in Point Chevalier for a few months with my mother and sister when I was a very little girl. And we boarded, my mother and my sister and I, in the front room of somebody's house, and my mother taught at a school, I don't know where, I don't know the street, it seemed very long when I was young. And I don't think we were allowed to be noisy. We had to be joyful quietly. And that's not good for children. But you can bring exuberance to it, but you can also bring awe. And last night, we just stood on Hilary's back porch, and the clouds were curling in this awesome way. And at the moment of recognition of that, what you could feel, what I could feel, and I guess Hilary was feeling also, was joy, but also a renewal of hope and a renewal of connection. And we need that. We need to live hopefully. And we need to live in connection with beauty and with kindness and with all the other qualities that we could call virtues. So I just want to make that distinction again. The joy is what arises from these moments of connection and then gives way to and allows those utterly vital qualities like hope and courage and forgiveness and renewal. So rather like with the meditation that I gave you, when you're feeling joy, you're feeling it in this moment, in this body, in this life, and it's enough. So joy is also an experience of enoughness, and that's also a really vital thing. And there's a lovely paradox here, because as conscious as we need to be, and as free in our choosing to live joyfully, bravely, alively, as conscious of that as we do need to be, some of our moments of greatest joy will also be our moments of least self-consciousness. I wrote about that in Intimacy and Solitude, and when I was thinking about being with you this evening, I remembered that sometimes we are most ourselves when we forget ourselves and we are just being. You know, we are just being. You know, we're talking with our mouths full and our, you know, we've got spinach between our teeth, but we're just thrilled with the moment because we are connected to what is happening. We're not judging, we're not criticizing, we're not withdrawing, we're throwing ourselves into it. So I think joy is also an invitation to abundance. That however long we have this life, let us not starve it. Let us not starve it, even of our gratitude for it. We can grow so skilled, I think, in, you know, things not being okay. And very often they are not okay. And this topic tonight arose out of a very not okay time in my own life that had seemed to go on for rather a long time, and also in Hillary's. And we were speaking to each other for 20 minutes or so on the phone about various things, including this service this evening. We had a perfectly serviceable topic. Thank you very much. Perfectly serviceable topic. And then right at the end of the conversation, this word emerged. This word tapped us on the shoulder, joy. But what we recognized mutually in the very same moment was that the real spiritual exercise and the real spiritual commitment here, not just, you know, it's psychologically better for you to feel up and down, but the spiritual exercise of it was to claim it as essential to your essential nature. That when you move too far from aliveness, you are also moving too far from your essential nature, and you need to bring yourselves home. You need to know also what will bring yourself home. And for different people, it is different things. It happened in that moment, you know, because Hillary and I have been spiritual companions for a very long time, and we inspired one another. We need to honor and value all our sources of inspiration, whether it's our own garden, whether it's our companions, whether it's our companion, whether it's our books, whether it's music, whether it's nature, whether it's the work we do, whether it's the work we don't do. We need to know what will inspire us and reignite that essence in our hearts, because otherwise life is very hard. And I want to take you back to the reading from Rumi just for a moment. Sorrow prepares you for joy. Now, isn't that a most exquisite paradox? That we would hardly recognize our need for it until we need it. And this is where need is such a powerful meditation bell. When we need something, listen. When we feel emptied of something, listen. When we're hungry for something, listen. Because that is what you need. Yeah. And in that moment, Hillary and I needed, oh, we did, we needed more joy. We needed something that was going to lift us from feeling that we'd been rather too long in the valley of the shadow. So Rumi, of course, says, what seems to be keeping you from joy may be what leads you to joy. And sometimes that is a feeling that may not, or a feeling that arises from something that can be quite unconscious. Do I deserve to be joyful, or to be fully alive, or to be fully present to something that is beautiful or rewarding or delightful or marvelous, when there is so much suffering in the world, not just my personal suffering, but there is so much suffering in the world. Which, of course, takes us to the next thought, and we need to be taken to the next thought, because we will address our personal sorrows. We will heal from our personal sorrows. We will incorporate the learning from our personal sorrows most effectively when we are not crushed by sorrow, when there is also room for joy to come in, or for connection, or for peace of mind, or for stability, or for respite. We can't be hurtling all the time. It is against nature. And how do I know that? Because nature itself tells us that there are times of darkness and times of light, that there are times of growth and times of invisibility. There are times of blossoming and there are times of falling. Our nature cannot survive constant hurtling. And our natures also cannot survive a winter with no spring promised. In the course of a single day, in the course of a single hour or moment, we can move from one season of thinking and feeling to another. That's quite an exquisite capacity that the human mind has, that all the growing things, the growing beings, the forms of growth outside ourselves don't have. It's a gift of consciousness that we can move from winter to spring in less than a thought. Isn't it? And you can allow that to inspire you. So, for example, a difficult moment, and you could just dwell with that moment, or you could dwell with that moment in accompaniment, for example, with a piece of music that allows your heart to open. It might even bring tears. It might even bring much more explicit sorrow. But it also allows for the connection and the renewal of hope that are the harbingers of joy, or that are the expressions of aliveness. There's a lovely little quote here that says, "We truly need little to feel abundant." Now, I hesitated slightly to bring that because it takes me to the awareness that we have choices constantly about what we pay attention to, and yet, and I wrote a lot about that, as you know, in Forgiveness and Other Acts of Love, but it doesn't always feel like a choice. Sometimes we are so colonized by an experience, or our concerns about an experience, or our outrage or indignation or hurt or whatever it is, that choice seems to have taken up residence in a land far away, if not another planet. So, in those moments, aliveness can teach us something really subtle that I think is very, very helpful, which is that we can do what I just described. We don't need to say to ourselves, "Oh God, I'm a frightful person. I'm thinking those same thoughts all over again. I should be thinking joyful thoughts. Oh gosh, if only I was, you know, a bit more joyful, I'd be a bit more joyful. Or if only I was a bit more enlightened, I'd be more joyful." Or some other way of, you know, diminishing what we're actually experiencing. Allow yourself to experience what you are experiencing, but bring another element to it. Bring an element to it that also allows for greater spaciousness and for grace to arise. So sometimes this means moving ourselves into a different physical space. Sometimes it means bringing ourselves into different company. Sometimes it means writing about something and asking, what am I not seeing? Sometimes it means bringing music. Sometimes it means doing something that is itself satisfying. In other words, enlarging your repertoire so that you're not stuck with whatever is narrowing the mind, but rather returning yourself to what not so much enlarges the mind as enlarges your vision of what the mind is and can do. I also think that it is incredibly loving to ourselves and serves love well if, when we are in a prolonged period in which joy seems to be not a constant visitor, that we stand back a little bit and make a kind of audit. Make a kind of audit of what literally lifts the body and lifts the spirits, and also an audit of what seems to be cramping us or contracting us or diminishing aliveness or even cultivating what is hurtful and harmful to us. Doing this, we do it best when we do it from the perspective of joy itself. When we ask joy, what do I need to know here? When I ask joy, how can you be more radiantly expressed in this very difficult time in my life? When I ask joy, what have I put in front of you that is impeding me from seeing you as clearly as I would like to? Because joy is part of your own nature, it will express itself through you in your own way. There is not a recipe here. There are just shared insights, just shared inspirations, which you could equally give to one another. But your experience of joy is so unique that it also has something quite exquisite, quite beautiful, quite wonderful to share with you. And very central to that, very deep within that, will be a kernel that we do all share. And this is the kernel of gratitude for this gift of life itself. This is the kernel that is so easily overlooked and forgotten because we can be so distracted by the ways in which life out there and life in here is so highly problematic. Let joy remind us of this intense and immense gratitude for this brief, flourishing, radiant gift of life that each of us has, and that it is so easily forgotten. So I'm going to just finish by reading you a tiny story. which is in the book that's in my bag over there. Some of you have heard this story before. How lucky you are that you will hear it again. Some of you haven't heard this story before. How lucky you are that you will hear it for the first time. The story comes to us from Thomas Merton, who struggled a lot with these issues of how can we feel joyful when the world is full of suffering? How can we attend even to our spiritual development when we should be out there being activists all of the time? How can we combine contemplation with action? These are profound questions that I'm sure are in your minds and hearts very constantly. So just before I read this, and because I won't see some of you again for some time, I want to remind you that your action takes a very different tone. I don't mean that it has to be more effective. It may even be less effective, and that may be good. But action arises differently when it arises from a contemplative heart. And action also arises differently when it arises from a heart that knows and welcomes joy as well as sorrow. Yeah. So Thomas Merton, on the 18th of March, 1958, the 18th of March is the birthday of my granddaughter, who's just turned 5. And he had this experience. In Louisville, on a corner of 4th and Walnut, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all these people, that they were mine and I was theirs. That we could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. It was like waking from a dream of separateness, of spurious self-isolation in a special world. The whole illusion of a separate holy existence is a dream. Oh, I so wish we had more time, because of course joy is very contagious. And so is sorrow. So when we feel joy, we also benefit others. This sense of liberation from an illusory difference was such a relief and such a joy to me that I almost laughed out loud, as if the sorrows and stupidities of the human condition could overwhelm me now that I realize what we all are. And if only everybody could realize this, but it cannot be explained. There is no way of telling people that they are all walking around shining like the sun.